TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Northern California Land Back Symposium 2023, panel on land grab universities. How the Morrill Act of 1862 gave nearly 11 million acres of land taken from more than 250 tribal nations to finance 52 land grant colleges. In 1997, I stepped into the tribal office at Fort Belknap, Montana, and asked permission to set up a micropower radio station for the two-day conference by the Indigenous Environmental Network. There were two maps of North America on the back wall. The first, dated 1492, was red from sea to sea. The second, showing the United States of today, was almost all white, with tiny red specks showing the current Native American reservations. Land-grant universities got their money through land confiscations, often through violence and threats. The Land Back Symposium was a day-long event at Cal Poly Humboldt, Arcata, California, held on March 24, 2023. A powerful movement of land return is spreading across the world and has even reached some support from state governments. The Land Grab Universities session was led by Dr. Brittany Orona, Hoopa Valley Tribe, and the panelists were Hilo Ramirez, Mashute Indian Tribe at the Chico Rancheria. Rachel McBride Pretorius is Yurok and works at Chico State University. Fenosha Bowerly is Crow from Montana and Director of Native American Student Development at UC Berkeley. And Adam Cantor is Natural Resource Director for the Wiod Tribe. Early on in this discussion, Fenosha Bowerly pointed to an essential research tool, an award-winning book and interactive website that has a near-complete listing of the parcels taken from Indigenous land under the Morrill Act of 1862. The listings show the name of the native tribe and that of the recipient university. This Land Grab U project was completed by investigative reporter Tristan Artone and the historian Robert Lee. On the database of the website at www.landgrabu.org, and that's spelled landgrab plus the letter U.org, you may be able to find, as I did, that a parcel of redwood forest a few miles from where I now live, was given to Auburn University, Alabama, to finance their operations under the Morrill Act. The University of California ran a real estate operation that sold plots on installment plans. In the late 19th century, income from the fund, traceable to the lands of the Miwok, Yokuts, Gabriel Leno, Maidu, Pomo, and many more, covered as much as a third of the University of California annual operating expenses. Many Morrill Act parcels have been sold since the mid-1800s, or logged or mined for the benefit of the land-grant university. The website landgrabu.org shows some photos of the current use of these parcels. On the smaller plots, there may be now a Walmart, or a junkyard, or parking lot, or military cemetery. But quite a few parcels are still in the possession of the recipient university, and they could and should be returned to the tribes most easily. And indeed, the first efforts of land return are being undertaken right now, and the four panelists in this session are all involved in the early steps. Here's Dr. Brittany Orona asking the panelists to introduce themselves.
So my name is Brittany Arona. I am a member of the Hoopa Valley Tribe. I am also an assistant professor of American Indian Studies at San Diego State University. And I'm also proud to serve as the board secretary for Save California Salmon, an organization that I've been honored to be a part of for the last few years. So it's really great to see everybody here for this conference. It's a really, really important conference that we are coming together to talk through some of these issues around land back. I'm also very pleased to be the moderator for panel number two, Land Grab Universities, the California Context. And we have a great and awesome group of speakers here to talk to you about the nature of land granting institutions in California, how they have perpetuated native land loss through the university and academic system, and then the ways in which all of our panelists are working towards land back in these institutions. So I am going to let the panelists introduce themselves to tell us about your work with universities and land back. And then we'll also get into a few preset questions. But then after that, we will have a Q&A, and it's such great energy here, and I'm really happy and glad to be here. Without further ado, I'm going to pass it down.
Hetanayam Winameki, Nikiam Sahilo, Nikima'a Machokto, Benanai, Nihai Environmental Director for the Machupta Indian Tribe at Chico Rancheria. So, good day, y'all. My name's Hilo. My people are the Machupta, and I'm very happy to be here today with all y'all. And I'm the Environmental Director for my tribe.
Hey, Kui. Good afternoon. My name is Rachel McBride Pretorius. I am the Director of Tribal Relations at Chico State. I am Yurok, and I'm glad to be home. And I thank the Wiyot people for allowing us to be here, and it feels good to be home.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Fenosha Bowerly. I am the Director of Native American Student Development at UC Berkeley. I also sit on the UC System-wide President's Native American Advisory Council. I am Absalika, or Crow, from Montana, so I also appreciate the Wiyot people welcoming us onto their land and acknowledge I'm also a visitor here. Thank you.
Adam Kanner, Natural Resource Director for the Wiyot Tribe. About a decade, a botanist and ethnobotanist, and that's about a blip of time and a spectrum of time immemorial, so I'm happy to be here today.
So to start it off a little bit, could you tell us about your work with universities and land back, and then how your current work is related to the land back movement?
So since time immemorial, the Machupta Indian Tribe has stewarded, occupied, and managed the lands on Eskenham Shewe, Otakam Shewe, and the Tsuwotim in what is now Butte and Glen counties. So that would be the Big Chico Creek watershed, Butte Creek watershed, and the Sacramento River. Our ancestral lands include what is now Chico State University, which also includes our former rancheria. Our former rancheria, about 20 acres in whole, is now partially the South Campus of Chico State during the era of termination in the 1960s. The federal government terminated our federal recognition and then sold half of our reservation to the Chico State and the other half to the city of Chico. Due to this shared history of our village sites being on campus and former rancheria occupying a part of campus, we have a very close relationship with Chico State University due to a largely new administration with President Gail Hutchinson a few years ago. And the development, if I believe it's the first Office of Tribal Relations within the CSU system when it was created. So a couple years ago or so, the Chico State University was wishing to work with their auxiliary enterprise, Chico State Enterprises, to give back the Butte Creek Nature Preserve, which has been managed by the Chico State Enterprise, formerly known as CSU Chico Research Foundation, for the last 20 or so years. And what was thought to be an easy thing, the Chico State has 100 acres of our sacred cultural lands. They wanted to give it back to the tribe. It should be easy. It wasn't. It actually needed to go through the state legislature. We had to change California state law to make it legal for the university to give us our land back. Big thanks to Assemblyman James Gallagher for pushing that through and changing the law. AB 379 was the law. And the previous law strictly prohibited tribes from being eligible for managing state conservation lands and taking state conservation loans for the WCB, the Wildlife Conservation Board. And I'll let my colleague here, Rachel, talk to the rest of that.
So as Hilo mentioned, so I came to campus and my position is one of the first in the CSU system to be located in the office of the president. Our president really wanted to acknowledge government to government relationships. So when I stepped on campus 5 years ago and was approached like, hey, have you ever thought about giving land back to tribes? And I'm like, well, yes, like, how do we do this, right? And so we started having conversations with the director of the ecological reserves and preserves. And as Hilo mentioned, thought it would be this really great, easy process, sign a few documents, we're done. And I think after our first meeting where we literally thought this was gonna happen because we could, from what our interpretation of regulatory codes were, we could do this, right? We could transfer to tribes. And when we were told within the first 5 minutes of the meeting that we have already used these regulatory codes to not transfer to tribes, we knew that this was gonna be a process and the fight was on, right? And so we started the process. Machupta was instrumental. They took the lead. As you know, we're public entity. So we were in the process to educate along the way, people and partners, supporters, or anyone who may have thought this wasn't a good idea. In the end, the legislation did get passed. And literally all we wanted to do is to have tribes put into this legislation to be able to transfer. AB 379, we thought it was a done deal. And I will say never underestimate the power of one person that has a lot of fear or is not knowledgeable about tribes, right? In the 11th hour, the legislation got taken off consent because of one letter that was written in opposition by a public nonprofit. So then again, the fight was on. So what we thought we were being, really careful with our timeline of 6 months through a bureaucratic process of the CSU or Chico State Enterprises turned into 4 years of long going conversations and battles. But the ultimate outcome was the property was transferred in September of this past fall. And so that was huge. And part of the reasons why we want to have these conversations is so that you all are very aware and know that these laws are changing, because another project that we are working on is transferring lands to Susanville Indian Rancheria, which was a different process. It's called Eagle Lake up in Susanville. And we're like, okay, so this is a little different process. We had to put it out for RFP. And as people mentioned earlier, taking the administrative burden away from these processes will be huge and should be our next priorities. And so we're like, but this one shouldn't be a problem because it's federal land, it's BLM. So we go up to Susanville. I think we have every single person that you can imagine from BLM, from the tribe and from Chico State represented in this room. We leave. Me being so optimistic and especially from our previous conversations with other state entities, as we're leaving, I'm like, so we're clear, this is the next steps and we are transferring this land. Yes, we get back. People have a lot more, they are a lot braver behind a computer. So we start getting some emails and realize, wow, we're not only gonna not get this done, but we need now a congressional fix to a bill to be able to transfer this land. So Susanville has stepped up. They have been pushing this bill, and I will say it went into effect in January to where now we can transfer BLM lands to federally recognized tribes, which bill fixed and passed. And so we are now meeting with BLM. We will be the first. And they are saying, well, we don't know the process. And I'm like, well, sure you do, because you've transferred to nonprofits and other governmental agencies. There's no difference. Tribes are now included in those categories. You do know the process. So we are in the process of doing that. And we are hopeful that that will be done in May or June. And we will be transferring that land back to Susanville. And at this point, we know how to do that, whether it's state, federal lands. If it's public lands, we need to figure out how to give it back.
Well, thanks. Yeah, so the WIAT's relationship with the university and land return Kutcha started to tell the story about the Gukdeaton Forest earlier, which we know today as the Jacoby Creek Forest. It's an amazing forest, one of the main tributaries here, the Wiggy and Humboldt Bay, in the Wiyot's ancestral land, which I'll thank Chairman Hernandez for letting me be up here to speak about this today in his opening earlier. And so a couple years back, the university somehow got this land given to them using state grant funds without ever asking the tribe if they had any interest in, you know, much less co-management and anything about the property. And I think that was about the time I met Kutcha. And as part of the recently formed Jacoby Creek Forest Advisory Committee, all the university folks are sitting up here at the table like we're sitting at now, and the tribe's kind of sitting, you know, back where you guys are. And I think we had to remind them that, you know, tribes are sovereign nations. They're at the same level with the federal government, never ceded their rights. And, you know, why are we talking about, you know, co-management? Why are we not talking about land return? Is what Kutcha says. And, you know, it threw a bunch of folks kind of just in a tizzy and sort of sent the whole advisory committee kind of apart. And then the pandemic happened, which I think was a convenient excuse for the university to not reconvene the committee, which we still have not had a committee meeting since the pandemic, and we continue to ask to this day. That kind of led to a couple years right around the same time. The Wiyots were huge leaders in protecting the sacred site of Sakiyuit, which is a Bear River Ridge, from an industrial energy project, which we know industrial energy projects have not had a good history and legacy impacting salmon and tribal species. And folks in the community started to say, well, the Wiyot tribe, they don't care about climate change. And we're like, what are you talking about? The tribes are the original stewards. They've been adapting to climate change since time immemorial. And around about that time, Dr. Laurie Richmond here at Cal Poly invited us to be part of the new Sea Level Rise Initiative. And I thought, this is the opportunity to show in the public light that the tribe really does care about climate resilience and climate change. And that led to a series of successful collaborations and grant proposals, until one day we saw this environmental justice posting for a new funding opportunity through the Ocean Protection Council, through Prop 1. And Secretary Crowfoot talked about this earlier today. And, you know, it was supposed to have a water quality nexus and benefit. And so we all know that returning land to tribes is the best thing you can do to protect water quality. And asked the funders if they would consider using the funds for a land return project. And they sat there and they kind of thought about it. And they're like, you know, why not? And that kind of led us down the road to crafting a proposal to try to purchase a property that, you know, coming, you know, if any environmental professionals, you know, in this room thinking about, you know, the way to really know the land is to be on the land and to know the critters and the flora and the species that are there. And then, you know, the places that are really fragile and need to be protected, because coupled with the climate crisis is the biodiversity crisis, and they're intertwined. And so we have to think of addressing those both. And through that process, I learned a lot about tribal sovereignty and, you know, the administrative burden that tribes have to take on funding and to collaborate. Tribes have a lot of high indirect costs, and universities, nonprofits, you know, see this as an opportunity to collaborate, and sometimes out of their own interests, you know, get funds, you know, I don't want to say using tribes, but working with tribes to have more competitive access to funding and grant funds. And so we thought, well, maybe the university is our solution to dealing with high administrative costs, and maybe they should act as a physical sponsor. And the grant went down the line. We were high up in the selection process, and we're really excited to hear that we got funding. And the grant had been separated. Part was going to go to the university and part was going to go to the tribe. For the university was going to manage the purchase, so indirect costs wouldn't be applied. And luckily, thanks to great leadership in the tribe, we saw that this would have been a huge violation to tribal sovereignty, that it would have led to another situation like what happened with Jacoby Creek, where now the tribe is potentially having to negotiate with the university to try to get land back. Meanwhile, the tribe, you know, the university is benefiting from the funding opportunity. But long story short, you know, we talked to the state, indirect costs were not applied, and the tribe was able to purchase the property using the grant funds, which was really awesome. And you know, there's a lot to be talked about, you know, deed restrictions. We're really excited about the deed on this property because we really had the state kind of force them to think outside the box. And one of the deed restrictions on the property is the burden property is restricted and shall exclusively be used for Wiat eco-cultural restoration in the deed restrictions. And so Secretary Coford also talked about eco-cultural restoration and how through ecological restoration and involving tribes, you're also restoring the culture. And I think that can really expand the activities that could happen on the property from, you know, just, you know, your traditional, you know, box of conservation, which excludes tribes from, you know, potentially building plank houses or other cultural restoration, you know, installations on properties. So we're excited about that. And we also got them to allow a pathway to move the property from fee into trust, which we thought was going to be an issue. Because of the use of state funds. And so we hope moving forward that this will help out other tribes as a precedent for working with the state to get land back so you can still uphold sovereignty and protect these important places for future generations.
Thank you so much for those really wonderful answers. And something that actually, Adam, when you were talking that I was thinking about, and I think it's a really great question from the last panel as well, is these kind of limitations that are placed upon tribes and also in the university setting for land return and like these deed restrictions.
Thank you for posing that question because it really is an important question. What is land back? Because Chico State through Chico State Enterprises gave that land to us. However, it has conservation easements and deed restrictions through the WCB to where essentially we have the right to manage the land, but if we don't follow X, Y, and Z, it can always be returned to the state of California. So we don't actually, in practice, 100% own it. And those deed restrictions are due to why the land was purchased in the first place back late, probably 1999 or 2002. So a little history about Butte Creek. It has the largest self-sustaining spring run, Chinook salmon run in the state of California. And this vital salmon run is imperiled. There's a series of PG&E dams in the foothills of the creek. And the spring run salmon aren't able to get to colder holding waters in the lower mountain, upper foothill region. They're stuck in the lower foothill canyon valley region where water temperatures, life history of spring run Chinook salmon, as we probably most know, they used to be able to take advantage of the spring floods, come up during spring, hold during summer, and then spawn in fall. Now they're holding in the valley where water temperatures are in 80 degrees Fahrenheit, much, much warmer than their 50 degrees to 40 degrees Fahrenheit needs are. So the land was purchased through WCB 2002-ish. For spring run Chinook salmon. So the deed restrictions involve managing the land for that and then also for the riparian ecosystem there. For the past 150 years, the land was gold dredged and gold mined. So they took the top 10 to 15 of topsoil, put it through a gold dredger, spit out the back. And when they needed to gold mine a different section of the canyon, they would just reroute the creek to the other side. We're here today. But these deed restrictions can be restricted to our own cultural use. For example, one of the just blanket laws or regulations, it'd probably be more fit to say regulations, policies, is nothing can be removed from the WCB lands. So if we're wanting to use the lands for our own eco-cultural purposes, like gathering basket material or gathering medicine, yerba santa, willow, et cetera, basket sedge, those deed restrictions can prevent us from doing what we wanted to do with the first place with the land.
Yeah. just getting to understand why land back. I mean, I think is at the center of some of this, that Chico State is a model, that they have a Office of Government Relations within the president's office that actually recognizes tribes as sovereign government, where I think a lot of institutions, at least particularly the UC I can speak for, tend to approach consultation and government to government relations only in really specific cases as like, we've checked the box and, you know, it's compliance, not really thinking about tribes as governments and as sovereign nations, and that you're coming from different places. So I think hearing these challenges around the deed limitations is also like, if the UCs or institutions are going to think about giving land back, which they should, it's also, we need to help encourage, I think some of my job and my colleagues' jobs within the institutions are to shift the needle from just thinking about it as compliance, as to thinking about it as like, this is ethics. This actually was land taken from, and that there's an understanding of how to be in relation with that land. And I think in a very annoying academic way, that is like our responsibility within the institutions of higher ed, because academics will take a very simple thing and turn it into a research project of their own, because that's how we think of knowledge production within institutions of higher education. These are colonial institutions. But if we can work, I think the challenges come with indigenizing ways of thinking and trying to get institutions to think about indigenous perspective as on the same level as Western knowledge. So I think challenges are the infrastructure, even having a government to government relationship, having people who understand that. I was just telling before we started, like, you know, it's Chico State's great. They have a California Indian working with California Indians on government to government relations that all California institutions should have, not pulling in somebody who you think it knows how to be nice with those tribes. So I think that's one, understanding what sovereignty is, understanding what consultation is. All of those pieces are really integral to shifting how we have these conversations about land back, because otherwise the bureaucracy kills us and the minutia kills us. What is the spirit of why we're doing this? Should it be because we can prove we need it, or because we can prove we do a better job? It's like, no, you took this. Now you didn't do well with this. Like, give someone else a chance. I think those are the challenges in institutions of higher ed that I'm seeing.
That was Rachel McBride Pretorius, Director of the Office of Tribal Relations at Chico State University. You heard excerpts from a panel on land grab universities, recorded at the Land Back Symposium at Cal Poly Humboldt, Arcata, on March 24 of 2023. An inspiring movement of land return is spreading across the world, and at least in California and in Brazil, they even reached some support by state governments. You can find videos of all sessions on the website of californiasalmon.org. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.